Today is Transitions Tuesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Transitions Tuesday, we focus on all things related to the many different kinds of transitions we all have occasion to experience in our lives. Today, we're going to be talking about the ability to get high and stay safe and sober. I know they don't sound like they belong in the same sentence, but they actually do. And I would like to introduce you to Jody Gould, who is the author of a provocatively titled book. It is entitled Hi, not Hello, but H-I-G-H, Hi, 6 Principles for Guilt-Free Pleasure and Escape. Jody Gould, welcome to Mind Talk. I'm not sure that we're aware as a people that there is such a thing as guilt-free and pleasure.
Oh, yes, absolutely. There are many guilt-free pleasures. I have just isolated 6 of the top that have actually been scientifically proven to reduce our stress, our anxiety, to last longer and be stronger than the kind of highs that we associate with drugs and alcohol. So, yes, there are guilt-free pleasures. And you mentioned off-the-air chocolate. I'm going to say, yes, that's one of them.
Okay.
And there's many, many more. So people can indulge in pleasures that do not involve chemical mood-altering substances. And I just want to also add that people shouldn't shame themselves if they enjoy a glass of wine with dinner or at a party,
right. As
I do, and I readily admit that I do. If there's nothing wrong with it, as long as you are not an addictive personality, an addict, or in recovery,
right. There's
absolutely nothing wrong with it. It can relax you. It can make you feel enjoy the situation more, and there's nothing wrong with it, and that it's been the need to relax and get high has been going on since the dawn of time. But at the same time, there are also ways that we can feel the same kind of joy without the risk of that comes with drugs and alcohol. So that's what the book's about.
Okay. Well, you talk about this kind of behavior existing since the beginning of time. And indeed, what you do in your book, which I was really fascinated by, was you take us through some of those more notable persons and periods of time and show us how drugs and alcohol was a part of the world then. Let's start with Noah. Noah was a pretty big deal in the Bible.
Oh, yes. He's one of the main features of the Bible, and I think most people are familiar with the story of the ark and the animals two by two, and how God called on him to cleanse the world, which he saw as being drenched with sin. But Noah, which few people, I guess people who know their Bible really well know, but apparently he had a liking for wine. And according to the book of Genesis, he discovered this, as humankind did, from watching the animals. And apparently he watched a goat frolicking after eating some fermented grapes.
Interesting.
And he decided to try it. And then he became intoxicated himself. And there is actually a passage in the Bible which says, when he drank some of its wine, he became drunk and lay uncovered inside his tent. And he confessed later to his sons about what he had done, and they felt badly about it. But, this did not make him a sinner. It just made him a human. So, and then, of course, he went on to fulfill God's wish. But that is a little-known fact in the Bible, I will have to say.
Absolutely. And then you talk about it's not, this kind of experience is not limited to one particular religious document or doctrine. You talk about what you learned in reviewing the Hindu texts about alcohol. What did the Hindus say about alcohol?
Well, there are some Hindus who believe that alcohol can be used to help in digestive problems and with breathing and voice. But there's also, at the same time, Ayurvedic medicine, which they do not, of course, condone, and all of the major religions do not condone drunkenness.
That's
across the board. And, of course, there are religions which forbid the use of alcohol entirely.
Absolutely.
But the Ayurvedic belief is that it is very dangerous to overindulge in alcohol, especially for people who have certain fears and anxieties. So there's that. Both of them exist at the same time. It depends on your belief. There are right. many different sects of Hindu religion, of course.
Absolutely. Now, talk to us about medieval times. What was going on there?
Well, we always think of the Middle Ages as the Dark Ages, and it was a pretty dark time. They discovered that cider and pumice wine could be made, and it was enjoyed by landowners and peasants alike. And later, grape wine came along, and that was preferred by the upper classes. So, you know, it was a very caste-oriented society. Mm. And beer was pretty much the drug of choice back then. And it was used to give laborers calories to help them deal with their physical work because it was very rough going. And so beer is, of course, calorie-ridden, as we all know. And it helped them in that way. But they also used it recreationally. They went to taverns. Taverns were kind of wild places, and there were prostitutes and gamblers. There was lots of singing and all sorts of stuff going on there. And then there were the inns, which catered mostly to the upper classes and much more expensive. So they probably would have their wine instead of the beer at the inns.
But
they had these drinking games. There's mm-hmm. one funny drinking game that I discovered in my research around the 1300s that was called a puzzle jug. And what they would do is they would poke holes in the jug, fill it with wine, mm-hmm. and then it would go around a room and have the patrons try to drink from the jug and see if they can do it without spilling onto their laps. And inevitably, of course, they would. And it gave everybody a big laugh. And apparently that game went on lasted for centuries.
Really?
It was so popular.
It's a puzzle jug.
It was called puzzle jug. Every period had a certain drinking game.
Amazing. Now, you also talk about Puritans and getting high, and nobody thinks, well, what you describe are Puritan pleasures. That's the way you title it.
And yes, which sounds like an oxymoron.
It absolutely does. So help me out with that.
The Mayflower, as it happens, contained more beer than water. Now, that could have to do with the fear of contamination, but that wasn't, in fact, the case. And, of course, the British have been drinking beers for a long, long time, so the pilgrims were more than happy to continue that tradition in the new land. So they did quite often partake of beer. And what I found surprising was that John Calvin and Martin Luther actually said that alcohol was a gift from God when used in moderation. But, of course, drunkenness, right. which is really forbidden in almost every major religion, mm-hmm. is a sin. But both Calvin and Luther said it was a gift from God, so...
So
that
was
a surprise to me.
Well, of course,
we think of Puritans as being completely
absolutely
abstemious.
Pretty dull, and they don't do anything, and they just work all the time.
Yes, and they did, and they read the Bible. That was part of their guilty pleasure, and they played games and they did other stuff, but they did enjoy their beer from time to time.
You know,
although they ended up importing it from England because the hops were not quite as good as they were in England. So props to the hops in England. Apparently.
So apparently they were particular about their beers.
Yes. They imported the hops from England because it was much better.
You know, what's interesting about this, I mean, these are all sort of fun and interesting mm-hmm. pieces of information. And they really are, because you just don't think about, you know, I think just as a society, we just kind of think that alcohol just sort of started someplace and grew and became more and more of a problem. And now here we are. So it's really mm-hmm. interesting to hear that there is a real history to the introduction of wine and beer and drugs into our society. And perhaps helps us to understand with a bit more compassion how and where we are today as a people, it's been around forever. And yes, there was never a wish for people to overindulge.
Right, right.
But, you know, for a lot of folks, once you start, it's really hard to stop. And that's mm-hmm. kind of a separate issue from the fact that these things have existed for absolutely years.
Yeah, since the dawn of time, as I discovered, there were apparently cave paintings that depicted the gathering of honey, which could be used to make alcoholic the very first alcoholic beverage. And this continued on throughout the ages, but that was, you know, about as early as archaeologists have discovered. And then, of course, it continued on. And we all, you know, have heard about the Roman bacchanalias. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, there was a dig recently, an archaeological dig that was done in 2012 in Israel, where they found 3,000 bottles of wine underneath a palace.
Wow.
And that's quite a lot of historic hooch. And we're not
Indeed.
Saying that everybody, you know, everybody got drunk, but part of the book is to take the shame out of this, what I found to be a universal human and animal drive to get high. And I found that it does have a biological and historical basis. And it comes from also a very human need to escape from pain and depression. That's part of the human existence.
Absolutely.
And this can be alleviated through chemicals, drugs and alcohol. But the second part of the book is divided into two parts. One is sort of an examination of this craving, this natural drive, which I see as similar to the drive for sex and food and thirst. And the second part, which is how we can obtain a similar, long-lasting, healthier, stronger high through natural pursuits. And then there are many. And that's where I call the pleasure principles come in.
And there are six that you go through in your book.
Yeah, so I just don't want people to feel shame if they have this desire to get high and to escape from the drudgery of life. I mean, we all have, you know, we all have sadnesses, we all have tragedies in our life. But I want them to know that there are things that they can do and that can help them feel just as good as they would if they turned to alcohol and drugs, and even better, and it won't put their health at risk or the risk of their friends and family.
So there's lots of hope, and there are lots of options, and I think you're right, because so often there's so much shame and blame that gets piled on top of the person who is labeled as an alcoholic or a drug addict or however folks are defining them, that it makes them hard for those folks and the folks who are labeling them to see that there is another way, another pursuit, another possibility. And they often only see those folks as bad. They're just bad people.
Yes. And in fact, I wrote another book about women and alcoholism with a recovery expert, and she explained how shame is part of the cycle of addiction. And they drink, and they feel guilt and shame, self-loathing for having, fallen off the wagon. So what do?
They drink more.
Again, to try to cover up the guilt and shame. So I want to tell people that if they look at this need to have an altered state of consciousness, it's natural, it's universal, it's part of the human and animal existence. But it's something that we can choose to. And I'm not saying that people should be completely abstemious. I want to confess that I enjoy wine with dinner, wine with friends at parties. In moderation. It's only if you are an addictive personality, an actual full-blown addict, or in recovery, that you should avoid these things.
Folks,
but if you can have your, one or two glasses of wine With dinner, that's okay. It doesn't make you an addict. Doesn't mean you're going to become an addict. Mm-hmm. But if you have tendencies,
just pay attention.
Be addictive. Yeah. Beware.
Folks, you are listening to the voice of Jody Gould, who is the author of High, Six Principles for Guilt-Free Pleasure and Escape. We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, Jody, I'd like to move on to a conversation about the brain, just to help folks understand that piece before we move into the actual six principles. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and we will continue with Jody Gould in just a moment. Hello, folks. This is Pamela Brewer, continuing the conversation with Jody Gould. Jody is author of High, Six Principles for Guilt-Free Pleasure and Escape, and that's High, H-I-G-H. Jody, talk to us about your brain on drugs. Talk to us about the primitive brain, the emotional brain, the thinking brain.
Well, what I discovered about the brain is that from researchers that I interviewed is that part of the reason that people become addicted, it has to do with the reward centers in the brain. Mm-hmm. And they say that when we have positive, pleasurable experiences, when we get high through chemicals and alcohol, we become we can become at risk of being addicted to that because we want to repeat that. Mm-hmm. It lights up that part of the reward center in the brain, and it makes us want to repeat it again and again. And the difference between those who can resist and those who can't are people who just they can't stop. They just want to repeat this very pleasurable memory, and there are certain triggers that can light up the reward system in the brain, and it produces these irresistible urges that bring them right back, circle them right back to the drugs and alcohol that brought them there in the first place.
The fact that the drugs and alcohol can actually have an impact on your brain, you know, I think a lot of folks don't really think about that in the way certainly that you've described, but don't think about it at all. Mm-hmm. But the brain is the thing that you'd kind of need to be alive in a lot of ways and to feel the world around you. When your brain is on drugs and alcohol and your brain starts to crave these things, then what do you do?
Well, there are, as I said, triggers that we need to avoid. The addicts that we talk to say that a smoldering cigarette can trigger you to want to have a drink because you associate that cigarette with having a drink. There could be groups of friends that you're who used to be your drinking buddies or your drug pals, and if you hang with them, you're going to go back, and you're going to want to do it again. So a way to get away from this and to change the brain's chemical pattern is to stay away from these triggers, avoid these triggers. Well, first of all, of course, if you're an addict, you have to go and get help. That's right. Number one.
Right.
We should start off right there. If you are an addict, you got to go to rehab. You got to go to seek professional help. And whether it's AA or some other program, get yourself some help.
And the good news is that again, help is available.
You got to develop resilience.
Yeah.
And the resilience is the ability to avoid the triggers in the brain that light up that reward system. And there are other ways to create actual chemicals, which we'll talk about later, chemicals which are similar to the effects of the chemicals that you get in drugs that are natural. And you can reproduce those great feelings that you get when you're taking drugs in a healthier way. So it's avoiding the triggers, having the support of positive role models and family members and friends who help keep you on the straight and narrow.
You know, as we talk about those who may be addicted and are paying attention to that fact, it's also important, certainly for those parents who are listening with college-age kids and those college-age kids who might be peering around the corner, that, you know, the idea that children, college-age students, are taking Adderall and Ritalin, which is typically prescribed for folks dealing with attention deficit disorder. Mm-hmm. What is the impact of Adderall and Ritalin on these college kids, and why are they taking it?
Well, it helps them to, it's originally prescribed for children who have attention deficit disorder, and it helps them to focus or hyper-focus on their studies, and that's or to calm down if they're hyperactive, if you have ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you've had a guest on to talk about this.
Yeah.
And when you take the drug, it does, in fact, do that. However, there is a risk of becoming dependent on this particular drug. And so you have to be very careful. If you are taking it and you truly need it to help you and you're under the care of a physician, that's
mm-hmm.
fine.
Mm-hmm.
But you absolutely should not take it recreationally, which has been done, and you should not overindulge in it because it could have some very negative side effects.
And, that's, you know, I would recommend for parents, you know, many parents will ask their child whether or not he or she is doing drugs, but
mm-hmm.
kids may not define a prescription medication as drugs in the same way that their parents are asking. And, you know, kids can be terribly clever about not answering what they don't want to answer.
That's for sure.
So I would just say to parents, when you're asking your child if he or she is taking drugs, or you're making an observation, that you're very clear that you're talking about illegal substances, legal substances, prescription, non-prescription. Just don't use the word drugs and assume that that covers everything, because it doesn't even begin to.
Well, that's absolutely true. And today our biggest problem drugs and medication is prescribed medication rather than what you get in the black market.
Right.
And that's our biggest problem. And also, we should mention, while we're talking about the brain, that the adolescent brain is an unformed organism.
Right.
And it is most dangerous for teenagers and adolescents to engage in any kind of drug or alcohol, because it can permanently affect the development of their brain. So that is important for parents to understand. I think parents understand they don't want their kids doing drugs, but actually, if they have a discussion with their kids,
mm-hmm.
that they could be permanently damaging their brain by doing this, that perhaps it might take some effect.
And I would say that parents need to do more than one, you know, conversation in passing, even if the kids don't want to talk about it. And really pay attention to how the kids are responding to you when you even ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe find out what's happening in the school, what kind of education is going on in the school around these issues. Let's talk about, before we move on to the actual principles, you talk about tissue tolerance in your book. What is tissue tolerance?
Tissue tolerance is when the body, now again, I'm a journalist and not a doctor, but I
gotcha.
Did learn this from doctors. Tissue tolerance is when the body resistance to the drug or the alcohol, which is a drug, and that is why alcoholics are made. Nobody takes their first drink intending to become an alcoholic.
Right.
But what happens is you take your first drink, and you feel better, and you say, "Okay, I want to do this again." And so you take another drink, but it doesn't have the same effect that the first one did. So you take two drinks, and then it becomes three, four, five, then it's a bottle,
right.
then it's two, and then
And you're off and running.
All hope is lost, you're gone. Same thing with crack, you know, same thing with cocaine. Your body develops a physical resistance to the drug, and then it needs more in order to get the same effect. And when it's at its worst, addicts don't use to get high. They use to level
live.
Out.
Yeah.
They don't even feel the effects of the high anymore.
Yeah.
It just maintains. And that's what tissue tolerance is about, as I understand.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to these six pleasure principles. And I know folks are wanting to hear about guilt-free. Sounds like a good place to go. So let's go there. Your first pleasure principle number one, is move.
Yes.
Talk about that.
It's got to be top of the list because it actually produces natural hormonal chemicals, endorphins, that are very similar to the kinds of feelings that you get through drugs. And everybody's heard about the runner's high.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a real thing. That's not an urban myth. They actually, runners have said that they feel euphoria after having run. So move doesn't mean that you have to, and I'll get into this in more depth, it doesn't mean that you have to be a marathoner or that you have to run. I personally don't like running. I spin. But there is a scientifically proven fact that physical activity produces natural mood-enhancing chemicals that make you feel high, make you feel great. And it doesn't have to be running. Not everybody, like Bruce Springsteen said, is born to run.
Right.
There's other things you can do, and I can get into that later. Did you want me to go down the line on the principles, then we'll get into them in depth?
No, I'd like to hear more about some of the other things you can do in the area of movement.
Oh, movement. Okay. So now, as I said, not everybody needs to join a gym or run I know there are people who just hate to exercise. So for them, I say walk it off. There's so many other things you can do, and you can do it. It doesn't take a lot of your time. You could just park farther away from the shopping center or wherever you're going to do your errands and walk.
Okay.
You could use the stairs instead of the elevator and the escalator and get some great cardio workout that way. You can attach ankle weights hidden underneath your pants so nobody sees them, and I'll give you a little bit of a more of a cardio boost. And to sort of combine pleasure principles, I recommend getting a buddy and having a going out for your daily constitutional with a friend or a group of friends, having a walking group, because that will help motivate you. Because a lot of the problem with physical activity for people who are exercise haters is it just, you know, they need somebody to motivate them. But it is proven that the more you increase your heart rate, the more endorphins you produce and the better you're going to feel. Because endorphins are natural opiates. And it's going to make you feel good. So for those haters out there, try it. try it. Whatever it is that you like to do. You could also join... as I said, not everybody can afford to join a gym, but you could also join a team. And this is especially good for men who tend to prefer team sports, although women are getting much, much more involved. Stop coaching your kid from the sidelines. Join a team, man. Join a soccer group, a softball. They probably say baseball. Women join a softball.
Not a bad
football
plan.
Group, pickup game in basketball. You know, get off the sidelines
or
do it.
And you know, there are even those mall walking groups that people are.
Mall walking is great.
Joining.
Mall walking is great. It doesn't matter. You walk around your block.
Right.
You walk around your neighborhood. You walk around the mall. It doesn't matter where you're going.
Just move.
And get a pedometer, which counts the number of steps.
Okay.
If you're a Type A competitive type, have a little. A challenge with a friend of yours. At the end of the day, see who took the most steps. And then you can reward yourself by taking your friend out for not a drink, but the lunch, a healthy lunch.
Sounds good.
And there's ways to reward yourself for exercise if you are, you know, if you're hesitant. You can get a jump rope. Here's another way. If you can't afford to join a gym, get a jump rope. If you live in an apartment like I do, be careful of your neighbors.
Right.
And don't jump on a carpet or concrete because it's not good for your joints.
Okay.
But find a place where it's got a little bit of give. Sugar Ray Leonard, everybody knows, the legendary Sugar Ray Leonard, he said jump light, imagining that hot coals are under each foot. So that was his advice when you're jumping rope. And also another bit of advice from a professional boxer who I interviewed, he said get a heavier rope rather than lighter rope. Now, it might sound counterintuitive, but for newbies, it's actually easier to jump rope with a heavier rope.
Oh,
and make sure that it has a rubber grip.
Gotcha.
So that doesn't cost much, and you can do it at home. So those are some suggestions.
That's
terrific. And then, of course, there's for thrill seekers, you know, there's all different types of people. There are thrill seekers who, you know, enjoy literally getting high by climbing up a mountain. And that's a fantastic thing that you can do. People like the need for speed. They can ski, surf, skateboard, zip line.
As long as you're moving. Just keep it moving, literally.
Yeah. I mean, because what you get from that chemically is the endorphins, is you get a real rush. You know, from the thrill sports,
gotcha.
You get a real rush. So that and surfing and all that. I mean, it may be for the younger members of the audience, but, you know, those kinds of things, if it's exciting, you're going to continue to do it.
Absolutely.
And you're going to get that rush.
Folks, we're going to take a break. We're talking to Jody Gould, author of High, H-I-G-H, Six Principles for Guilt-Free Pleasure and Escape. We'll be right back when we return, Jody. We're going to talk about principle number 2. Back and we are talking with Jody Gould about principle number 2 of the 6 principles for guilt-free pleasure and escape. Jody, you talk about relaxation, you talk about mm-hmm. spirituality, you talk about sleep, and then mm-hmm. you give a recipe for a do-it-yourself massage. Mm-hmm. Please help me with that one.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do a do-it-yourself massage?
Oh, that came from someone. I'm going to have to tell people to look in the book for that, because that came
okay.
from someone who is a professional. And she used, but I will say that it's the use of aromatic hot oils.
Okay.
And in the book it outlines exactly, you know, how to do it in terms of massaging the head and moving down to the shoulders and the legs and so forth. But it can be done. And there's two elements going on. There's the relaxation that comes from the aroma of the hot oils, is the relaxation that comes from the actual massaging of the muscles, which has been proven to reduce stress, anxiety, and depression. All these things, it's so surprising to some, but they are scientifically proven activities that help us in terms of our health. It helps reduce not only our stress, but depression, and even can prevent some diseases. and massage is definitely one of them. I highly recommend it. If you can't afford to go to the table massage. Now, I live in New York City. Everything's expensive. They have, and I hope people have this somewhere in their town, nail salons that will do chair massage for 10 minutes. $10
yes.
for 10 minutes.
And
get a pedicure, or you could go get a pedicure, and they will massage your feet. You know, I find it one of the most wonderful ways that I can just unwind and relax and get like a mini massage, and it helps. So I recommend that to people. Ten minutes, $10, you can do it.
And, you know, what's interesting is that it does so many of the things that folks who are turning to a drink or a drug, it does it right there, and you're getting the physical benefit of it. You know, just the intention of the massage and the attention to that part of the body, and the relaxation that is a natural outflow of that. It's just amazing. Talk about sleep. We hear a lot about sleep. Why is sleep and why is spirituality? Why are both of them in a principle about restoring yourself?
Well, I'll start with sleep. Sleep, we are without a doubt a sleep deprived country. There's no doubt about it. With the economy being the way it is, people are working harder, they're working longer, they're more than one job. We are just, you know, parents, I don't even have to tell parents of babies how much sleep you lose, and it's like torture. I mean, when you don't get enough sleep, you are just not functioning on all cylinders. You feel like you're hungover, really. I mean, it's just your brain doesn't work properly. It is so essential. Sleep is one of the most essential ways that people can revitalize their selves and their spirit. So we need to get more restorative sleep. And it has been, again, turning to science, proven to reduce depression and stress when we get more sleep. And there is no, I know there's been some talk about how much is, what's the magic number for how much sleep we need. Apparently the latest findings is there's no one size fits all for the amount of sleep that we need.
Okay.
But what's important is that we can get, that we get at least 4 or 5 REM, rapid eye movement cycles, which is when we are in our deepest stage of sleep, and it's when we are dreaming. And that's ideal if you can do that. So I know it's tough for people, but when you dream, especially if you remember your dream, it can be like having a trippy experience. You're like, because our dreams are crazy, right? So it's having a natural trippy experience when you are dreaming, and especially when you remember it, obviously. And if you have a bad dream, all you have to do is wake up. So. The other thing is babies are not the only ones who need naps. It has been shown that naps for adults are a good thing, and that even 10 minutes has been shown to improve our brain function and to reduce our stress levels. So if you can do it, try to take a little nap, and that will help, and that will help reset or reboot your body and your mind.
And one of the things that I would say about sleep, so many times in my office, I'll hear people say, well, I'm not sleeping well, but, you know, that's no big deal. It is a very big deal. And if you're having sleep challenges that are lasting you for more than a few days, my recommendation would be that you immediately get in to see your healthcare physician to begin to get a sense of what's going on and what you can do to change that.
Oh, I agree 100%. Get professional help. There are actual sleep centers that you can go to that will study you and help you put you on some kind of routine to help you get sleep.
So absolutely.
100% with you on that one.
Let's talk about connection. Why is that part of your six principles?
Oh, that's one of the most important principles on the list. In fact, there was a study that was a survey rather that was commissioned for the book, and that was number 3 on the study for men and women who felt it was their favorite pleasure principle, connecting, which is bonding with family, friends, and community. And that has been proven to help us in myriad ways. It helps our health. again, it helps reduce our stress. It helps us reduce our depression. Bonding with family and friends is a self-affirming and can be a spiritual experience as well. Those of us who were raised, lucky enough to be raised in nurturing households with good parents are less likely to fall prey to addiction and drug and alcohol abuse and certainly have an easier time with recovery. If you've got those family and friends who are on your team, it'll certainly help in that way. And you have to be careful when we talked about those triggers.
Yes.
If you are socializing with people who you were formerly doing drugs with or your drinking buddies, you might just have to get a new group of friends.
Yeah.
So there was a really interesting study that was done in the 50s called the Rosetto Study.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked at a group of immigrants from Italy who moved to Pennsylvania. And at that time, the 50s, you know, the diet was steak and potatoes, high cholesterol, and they were doing everything wrong. They were not eating the Mediterranean diet, which we know is what we should do today, even though they came from Italy. They were eating the worst kinds of foods you could possibly eat in terms of your cholesterol.
Mm.
But the doctor who studied these people found out that nearly no one in this group died of a heart attack under the age of 55. And why is that? Since their lifestyle, they weren't exercising either. So if they were doing everything wrong, why were they so healthy? Well, they discovered that it's because they lived in a close-knit family. They were spending time together. They were going to church together. They were visiting one another frequently. Mixed generations of people were getting together, which is also a wonderful thing.
Interesting.
And they were a healthy, close-knit social people, and this is what made them so physically healthy. So there are physical benefits to connecting as well as psychological benefits.
And, you know, the piece that I would just like to add in terms of socializing with your drinking buddies, perhaps a way to think about that is that part of your recovery is really gifting yourself and gifting yourself with healthy relationships. And those folks who are living in a space that you no longer are,
mm-hmm.
they're just in a space that you're no longer in. You don't have to blame them or shame them either. But a gift to you is to be around new people who, quite frankly, are more affirming and don't have the need to use drugs and alcohol as a way to escape whatever their lives are.
Beautifully put.
The principle number 4, create.
That's a good one.
I absolutely love that principle. Talk about how principle number 4 fits in to the pleasure and escape in a healthy way concept.
That was actually tied as number 3 in the survey, along with socializing and connecting as one of people's favorite pleasure principles. And people get so much from creating. Whether it's music, art, writing, it's about expressing and expanding your inner self. And there is a little more rewarding than doing that for most people. And there are so many ways that people can do this. There's the healing power of music. And in this internet age, people have Spotify, iTunes, Pandora, and such. And you can be your own DJ and put together your own playlist and listen to that and just enjoy the calming and wonderful effects of music. Oliver Sacks, the great Oliver Sacks, wrote a book called Musicophilia, and he said that music can move us to the heights or depths of emotion. And what could be a better high than that? Music was used to soothe is being used to soothe premature infants. You know, it's used in nursing homes. Music is one of the most wonderful ways to create. Now, if you can do more than listen and you have the ability and the talent to learn to play an instrument, even better. That's a fantastic thing. It's actually really good for your brain, as I found from yet another book that I wrote. If you can sing, join a choir, join your church choir, join a chorus, community theater group. All these are ways that you can sing. You don't have to be a professional. You could just join, as I said, an amateur group and get the same wonderful benefits from using the instrument that is your voice.
Absolutely.
I am a writer, so I can tell you that writing is one of the great ways to be creative. And nowadays, there are so many people who are writing. There are citizen journalists, there are bloggers.
Right.
There's Reddit, Wattpad, there's self-publishing.
All kinds of stuff.
And then there's also the old-school journal. Nothing wrong with taking a book and writing down your thoughts, your dreams, your blessings in a journal where you're actually writing by hand.
Which is very powerful, which is actually something that I recommend to folks sometimes when I ask them to write, is to write by hand.
Oh, yes, it's good.
It's really important. Folks, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to pick up with Jody, and we're going to talk about how to celebrate and how to give and how it soothes you and heals you and actually takes you to a lovely, pleasurable place. We'll be right back. Jody, one of the things that strikes me as we're talking, going through the pleasure principles, is that these are all things that we can do for ourselves, with ourselves. We don't need to have money. We don't need to go to school to figure it out. We can do these things on our own, often do, but if we do them with a more intentional perspective, how powerful and empowering all of these principles can be for all of us.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I say that celebrating is a way of affirming life and experiencing joy.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people are so bogged down, and I sadly include myself in this, with work and other obligations, that we forget to celebrate. We forget to celebrate the simple things in life, and the blessings that we're given in life. And some of the ways that we can do this are by celebrating milestones,
mm-hmm.
birthdays, weddings. Think how much fun you have when you go to a wedding. And what's so funny about all these principles is that they sort of combined others. They're sort of mixed in. Of course, you go to a wedding and you're dancing, so you're moving and you're creating, right? You go to a graduation, you go to a christening, a bar mitzvah. It doesn't matter what it is. Valentine's Day, celebrating your love. It doesn't matter what the celebration is.
It could be Tuesday.
Another
because,
way to affirm
absolutely.
Life. And there are other ways to celebrate, which don't involve holidays or milestones or that kind of gathering. And one of the biggest and best ways to celebrate is through laughter. Mm-hmm. And that was the number one, which surprised me, because I thought it was going to be connecting with family and friends. That was the number one pick for the people's favorite pleasure principle, was laughing. That's good news for the comedians out there, because laughing is actually a physical release. I mean, think about how you feel when you've had a great laugh with a friend, or you saw a comedy or a stand-up, and you just actually physically feel better. Because once again, scientists have discovered it, because they're always taking pictures of our brains, their MRIs, and they see how the brain centers, the reward center, lights up when we laugh. And so, again, you can light up that reward center going back to the brain through chemicals, through alcohol, but you can also do it through laughter. So I tell people to go out there and have some fun, see comedy, hang out with your friends who are funny, and just laugh it up. Now, there's something that started in India called Laughter Clubs, and now they have them here in the United States. They're gaining in popularity. It's sometimes called Laughing Yoga. And it's where you get together and with, again, a group, so this is connecting to, and you laugh. Now, sometimes they actually force the laughter. They'll get it in the group and say, and just start going, ha, 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 and then they'll feel silly, and it'll turn into actual real laughter. And this apparently works to help reduce stress. What they do in India, they do this before they go to work.
Amazing.
And it just sort of sets a great foundation for their day. But this does exist, and if you want to look it up and Google it, there may be a laughing group in your town nearby. But it has been known to really help. Even faking a smile, even if it's not real, has been known to change your brain chemistry and make you feel better. And it's the same thing with laughing. So that's another therapy, another guilt-free pleasure principle that one can do, and it's totally free.
That's amazing.
Yeah. The other thing is vacations. And again, I've got to take some of my own advice because it's been way too long since I've taken a vacation. But think about how wonderful you feel when you go away and just relax. And it depends on the type of vacation you want to do, but just taking yourself out of your everyday life, it's really mixing it up. Again, it's great for the brain, but it's also so good for the soul to take a vacation. And what's so sad about Americans is that we don't take enough vacations. First of all, we're not given enough vacations by our companies, those of us fortunate enough to have jobs. They, 2 weeks is sort of the average, right? Now, that's not the case in Europe.
Maybe two weeks.
And European countries lead the way in terms of having the most vacation. They have a minimum of 3 weeks vacation. I have some French relatives. Every time I call them, they're on vacation. I'm like, when do you work, for God's sake? I mean, bless their hearts, they're always going on vacation. They lead the way. Europe leads the way for vacations. They offer 34 days of paid leave each year.
Wow.
Imagine that in our country. Australia and New Zealand follow with 30 and 28 days of paid leave. Okay? Imagine that, folks out there in America. But if you can't get it from your company, you can give yourself the 2 weeks. The sad part of it is, even those of us who have the 2 weeks or whatever don't take their full vacation.
Or they take the vacation and they take it with their cell phone, their laptop, their notebook.
Oh, we didn't even talk about the unplugging, but yes.
Yeah. That's not a vacation.
No. Keep your cell phone off, please, because you're working. When you're I see people on the beach with their cell phones in there.
Right.
It really is. You've got to unplug completely. And apparently the average American worker leaves about 4 days of unused vacation each year.
And,
I'd say take it. Take your days.
In this economy where...
Yes.
Not only in this economy, but I mean just sort of generically, if you've got an employer or you're in a business that believes that, the way to take a vacation is just to work 15 hours a day instead of 18, that's a problem. And so for those of you who are either taking that perspective to your employees or to your employers, I would say Jody would join me in asking that you really rethink that, because you're going to wind up having a healthier, more productive employee when your employee has a chance to breathe and really relax.
Yes, I say amen to that, because you can tell your employer, and again, it has been proven that vacations create more productive employees.
Indeed.
And they are less stressed out. They make fewer mistakes when they are well rested. Vacations promote creativity. This has all been proven. Vacations prevent burnout, obviously, because mm-hmm. you're feeling more relaxed and it's like rebooting. You're ready to face the job. Vacations keep you healthier and happier when you recharge your batteries. Your stress level decreases. You feel happier. You have less physical complaints. Maybe you've slept a little bit more.
Absolutely.
Which we all know what that does.
Absolutely.
So it also strengthens bonds, again, these interconnections between pleasure principles. When you go with a loved one or with a group of friends, you could take a posse of friends with you and go on a vacation, have a great time, and laugh it up. Another pleasure principle.
Absolutely.
Recharges your batteries. It's one of the best things you can do.
Let's talk very, very briefly about giving. How is giving part of a pleasure principle?
Now, you know, I thought that was going to be one of the top ones, and it should be way up there, because giving, which is being of service and to others in your community or wherever that may be, is actually helps you find purpose in your life. Mm. And time again, person after person who I interviewed say the same thing, that when they volunteer, when they give of themselves, when they are involved in a charity, it completely transforms how they feel about themselves. It improves your self-esteem. It makes you feel more positive about life in general. And so I really can't say enough about how giving can really help you achieve that kind of life-affirming pleasure. I can talk about the science that it can enhance your immune system, mm. reduce stress. Once again, it helps us live longer. People who volunteer tend to have greater longevity in life.
Interesting.
Studies have said.
It's amazing.
It's one of the best things. Paying it forward is one of the best things that one can do.
Jody Gould, you have given us so much to think about and so much to sort of readjust in terms of how we care for ourselves. Jody, folks, is author of High, Six Principles for Guilt-Free Pleasure and Escape. In fact, she's the author of High, Six Principles for Guilt-Free Pleasure and Escape. Jody Gould, thank you so much for joining us here on this edition of Mind Talk.
My total pleasure. Thank you so much to you for having me on.
All righty. It's been a great conversation. I've had great fun. And I think, folks, that you would agree with me that Jody has brought us great information and sort of a shift in perspective about many important things. So thank you again, Jody, for that. And folks, thank you for listening to this edition of Mind Talk. Remember, you can listen to Mind Talk on demand at any time that you like at mindtalk.org. Anything you've heard that you want to hear again and again, just go to mindtalk.org. Managing producer is Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Thank you all. Mind Talk is produced daily as an educational public service and is not intended to replace treatment with a licensed medical or mental health professional or any professional that you choose to work with. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. It's 301-654-5286. And again, for more information about Mind Talk, please do go to mindtalk.org. That is mindtalk.org. And as always, I want you to remember, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.